Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 also in Albany. But we're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Livonia Mallory, and I'm still on my couch.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, still broadcasting from the foot of my bed. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first, Mark Dunley speaks with Roosevelt Institute economist J.W. Mason about the economics of a Green New Deal during a pandemic. Then on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory speaks with Michelle Jones Galvin, co-author of the new book, Beyond the Underground, Aunt Harriet, Moses of Her People. After that, Elizabeth Press discusses racism in the context of the pandemic with Anastasia Robertson of Justice for Damique. Then on Upstate Housing, Michelle Masurgeon talks about rent cancellation with Christian Garamoni from the Albany chapter of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And to close out the show, Eileen Javier speaks with Lisa Good, founding director of Urban Grief. But first, here are some headlines.
Mr. Floyd, a Black man, was killed in Minneapolis by police during a police arrest procedure on Monday. Two days before that, Detroit police were caught on camera punching a Black woman in the face with enough force to lift her off her feet. This in the wake of the March 13th police shooting of Breonna Taylor, a frontline EMT from Louisville, who after her apartment was mistakenly raided by police, she was brutally shot 8 times. And lastly, at least 7 people were shot Thursday during a Louisville, Kentucky protest in response to Breonna Taylor's killing.
The UN human rights chief on Thursday condemned the killing of 46-year-old George Floyd while in police custody in the city of Minneapolis, calling it the latest in a long line of killings of unarmed African Americans by U.S. police officers and members of the public.
Several county executives in New York have begun the second phase of business reopenings on Friday, even though there has been no official authorization or guidance from the state. The region said they will not wait for the governor to provide additional guidance or for his panel of experts to provide approval for phase two. The Troy Record reports that as Rensselaer County heads towards phase two of reopening next week, the county has now reached over 500 total confirmed COVID-19 cases, with 6 new cases announced Thursday.
When state lawmakers voted this week to repeal an 1845 law prohibiting the wearing of face masks as being outdated during the COVID-19 crisis, many Republicans argued against the repeal. Many Republican lawmakers refused to wear masks during the debate, with several admitting that Trump supporters back home would not approve of them taking such precautions. The mask law was initially passed in response to a tenants' uprising in the Hudson Valley that is sometimes referred to as the anti-rent war. Republicans argued that the prohibition was still needed for public safety.
Meanwhile, Governor Cuomo announced a new executive order that will allow private store owners to refuse service to people who are not wearing a mask.
Times Union reports President Trump tweeted that the federal government will provide $60.9 million to build the Purple Line bus rapid transit route from downtown Albany along the Washington Western Avenue corridor to the University of Albany, SUNY Polytechnic Institute, and Crossgates Mall. It's the third of 3 bus rapid transit routes planned by the CDTA.
A group of landlords in Westchester County on Thursday sued New York Governor Andrew Cuomo over his executive order extending a moratorium on evictions during the COVID-19 crisis, saying the measure violates their contract and due process rights and amounts to an improper taking of their property. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, and I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, send an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That's hmm@mediasanctuary.org. The Movement for a Green New Deal held a virtual rally on Wednesday to urge the state to take action as a way to respond to the COVID-19 economic downturn. Mark Dunley speaks with economist J.W. Mason of the Roosevelt Institute and John Jay College about the potential impacts of a Green New Deal.
We're talking with J.W. Mason, who is economics professor at John Jay College at CUNY and is also a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He spoke earlier this week at a virtual rally organized by a movement for a Green New Deal. And so, J.W., I understand you've been doing some of the, you know, economic foundation of, you know, can we afford a Green New Deal and how would the Green New Deal help us, you know, recover from this COVID-19 economic shutdown?
Yeah, that's right. You know, I and, of course, many other people have been talking about a Green New Deal for the last couple of years now, and I've, you know, co-authored a couple of papers out from the Roosevelt Institute about this, so it's been something that's been in the air, but I think the urgency of the kind of proposals that are around the Green New Deal is even greater now in the middle of this COVID crisis. You know, I think the big mistake, the big danger that we're facing right now is that we're going to have people say, oh, you know, we're in a recession, we need to tighten our belts, government has to do less, we need to pull back, we just can't afford to, you know, deal with the climate crisis right now. We have to defer that till times are better. And I think that would be a really serious mistake, of course, partly because of the urgency of dealing with climate now, but also because that sort of turn towards austerity, that kind of cutback in public spending is going to make our economic crisis much worse than it needs to be.
And I believe that, I think it was Oxford just put out a study a week or so ago saying that, you know, looking at prior, you know, recoveries from these sort of crises like the 2009 financial collapse, that, you know, sort of a green stimulus investment actually is more cost effective in terms of producing jobs, but also while, you know, improving the public health and standard of living for people.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the thing is, when you're thinking about, you know, the whole economy and you're thinking about government policy, you have to change your perspective a little bit from the way we're used to in daily life. So people see the amount of money being thrown around, you know, a sense of GDP, hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, over many years, and they think, wow, that's really expensive. But the thing is, when we're talking about the condition of our economy right now, the spending more is a good thing. The price tag is a feature. The price tag is actually another reason that we should be doing this. Because exactly as you said, you know, the stimulus 10 years ago after the financial crisis was certainly not big enough. But we also, I think very few economists would disagree. In fact, I've seen surveys of economists from across, you know, the sort of the range of opinions in the profession. And there's almost unanimous agreement that without that stimulus, the collapse, you know, after the financial crisis would have been a lot worse. That the only thing that really saved the country from a real deep depression was the fact that the federal government was willing to go out and spend a lot of money. Well, I think most people would say, and I certainly would say, that potentially the collapse in spending we're seeing now in the private side of the economy is even deeper than it was then. So we need even more public spending if we're going to fill that hole. And I think the arguments are pretty strong that one of the most effective forms of spending to boost demand and create good jobs is the kind of green stimulus spending that people talk about with the Green New Deal.
Now, the movement for a Green New Deal here in New York had asked for $10 billion in the recent state budget, didn't get anything as far as I'm aware. And now, of course, we got the situation with, you know, $10, $13 billion shortfall in the state budget. You know, can New York afford to do a Green New Deal, or we have to, you know, ask Congress to bail out and put money into a Green New Deal in New York at this point?
Obviously, Congress should be doing more, and we should be asking Congress to do more, and we should be asking Congress to do more to support New York and other states and New York and city governments as well. Absolutely. But the truth is, we don't know if Congress is going to be able to step up and do that. The response so far hasn't been bad, but there's always the possibility that Mitch McConnell is going to do what he seems to be saying he wants to do and just say, that's enough, we're finished. So if the federal government is not going to do more, then, you know, New York State cannot just sit on its hands and say, well, it's not our problem. New York State has to step up. And the truth is, even if the federal government is doing more, we still need to see more at the state level, too. This isn't a problem that any government can just sort of say, not our department. And the truth is, New York State has a lot of financial resources. You know, right now, interest rates are lower than they've been literally since the history of the United States begins. Interest rates on federal government debt, but interest rates facing big, you know, public borrowers like New York and various state authorities. The Federal Reserve has actually stepped up and said, we are going to support credit to state and local governments, which is not something they've done historically in the past. You know, of course, we know they support, you know, banks, they support the financial system, but they have not been willing to directly support borrowing by state and local governments, but now they are. So the Federal Reserve is basically sitting there and saying, we are going to make sure that state and local governments that want to borrow money are able to borrow money. And at the same time, interest rates are lower than they've ever been. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity for states to borrow big to fund needed public investment. You know, people say, you know, it's irresponsible to go further into debt. What's irresponsible is not borrowing the money when it's cheap and easy to do so and waiting till it may be much more costly. There's also obviously the potential for tax increases. You know, our governor has sort of had his signature thing being that he's against tax increases. He cuts taxes. But we have, you know, an enormous number of extremely wealthy people in New York. Since 2010, when Cuomo was elected, you know, more than 40% of the total income growth in New York State has gone to the handful of families, about 1%, with incomes over $1 million a year. These people have, at the same time, have been big beneficiaries of tax cuts at the federal level and, you know, to some extent, tax relief at the state level. There's an enormous untapped potential to raise taxes in a way that is not going to impact most people and is not going to have a big effect on demand. Corporate taxes are obviously much lower in New York than they have been historically, and actually today lower than they are in a lot of other states as well. So I think between, you know, borrowing money, and New York State absolutely should be borrowing a lot of money right now, and between raising taxes in a smart, progressive way, there's a lot of financial capacity. And the thing is, if you do that, if you go out and spend public money, the effect of that is to then create incomes for the people receiving that money. And those incomes get spent. So people are paying their rent on time. They're buying clothes, they're buying food, they're paying their utility bills. All of this stuff, well, it's stuff people need to do, but it also creates sales for businesses. That creates demand, it creates new jobs. If the state spends money, it primes the pump of the whole private economy. If the state does, you know, what it seems like the governor wants to do right now and says, oh, we're going to cut back, we're going to have, you know, austerity, we're going to, you know, lay off public employees. It's not just that we're not getting those public services. It's that all that lost income then, you know, cycles back through the economy and creates less demand for business and less private employment too. It's really short-sighted and counterproductive. You know, people will say, oh, well, you know, a family, you know, when hard times just has to tighten their belts. You know, we should run government like a business. Businesses cut back when the budget situation is not so favorable. But the thing is, the reason we have a government at all is to do the things that families and businesses cannot do. And one of the big things that they cannot do is spend money in a recession to keep it from turning into something much worse.
So we're talking with J.W. Mason, Roosevelt Institute, John Jay College about the Green New Deal. Sort of a two-part question. We have about 90 seconds left. You know, what are some of those key things to, you know, the state should invest in the Green New Deal at this point? And given somewhat the reluctance of Governor Cuomo to, you know, raise taxes and spend money, is there a role that New York City government could be playing at this point on a Green New Deal?
Well, I'd like to see New York City doing more. I mean, the reality is that our system here in New York does not give a lot of space for local governments to do a lot in terms of their budgets. You know, obviously taxing authority is almost completely out of the hands of the city. The city can borrow more within some limits, but it certainly doesn't have as much space as the state has. But yeah, I think we should be demanding more from every level of government. You know, if you go back to that financial crisis of a decade ago, there was a lot of federal stimulus. There were a lot of cutbacks at the state and local level that practically canceled that out. So I think we need to be pushing at every level of government and saying, now is the responsibility to be putting more money into the economy when the private sector is pulling back. Now is the right time. Whatever investment you've deferred, whatever public spending you've been putting off, now is the time to do that. And yeah, I think there's more space at the state level, but New York City and the city of Albany and every government in the state, I would hope, would be saying, what can we spend money on right now when borrowing rates are as low as they've ever been and when that spending is desperately needed by the economy?
J.W. Mason, if people want to find out any of your write-ins, you got a website or people can look at your stuff?
Yeah, jwmason.org on the web or at J.W. Mason 1 on Twitter and Blood Institute as well.
Well, thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio.
That was another good segment from Mark Dunley speaking with economist J.W. Mason of the Roosevelt Institute.
Next on Reclaiming History, Livonia Mallory interviews Michelle Jones Galvin, co-author of Beyond the Underground, Aunt Harriet, Moses of Her People, co-authored with her mother, Joyce Stokes Jones. In the creative nonfiction work, the descendants of Harriet Tubman tell the story of the famed abolitionist within the context of their family lineage, using an intricate mix of family lore, memoir, and historical reconstruction. I've been walking with my face turned to the sun.
Once again, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History with Livonia Mallory. I have a very special guest on the line today. We're going to be talking about a phenomenal woman of the past. Her name was Harriet Tubman, and the name of the book is Beyond the Underground, Aunt Harriet, Moses of Her People. What an amazing book, and I have the author on the line, Michelle Jones Galvin. Listen, thank you for joining us on another segment of Reclaiming History. Hey there, how are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Great to hear your voice.
Good to hear you too.
I'm just walking on a cloud. It's like sting.
It is. It is.
To read about Harriet Tubman, I had no idea how amazing she was.
She was amazing. She was amazing. And it really had a lot to do with the fact that she had made a decision. Once she was ready to leave that place, she was really ready to have one of two things. She would either have liberty or death. She literally meant that she would die or the right to be free.
Amazing. We're going to get right into the book. I read the book cover to cover. So for my listeners, tell them your full name. And you have a co-author on this book. Tell them her name. And what's the relationship between the two of you?
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much, Livonia. My name is Michelle Jones Galvin. And I am a great, great, great grandniece of Harriet Tubman. The co-author on the book, and we're really going to have to talk about this a little bit, is my mother, Joyce Stokes Jones. And she is the one that started this whole journey about trying to find out her exact relationship to Aunt Harriet. And she started in the 1970s, by the way, and took a very long time to connect all of the dots. And once those dots were connected and I began to work with her, we were able to compile all of that family history and historical information into the book, which we now call Beyond the Underground, Aunt Harriet, Moses of Her People.
Right. So, Ms. Galvin, how far back, how far removed, as other folks may say it, how far back is Aunt Harriet to you? She's your great-great aunt? How far back are we going?
We're going three greats, four generations. Great-great-great grand aunt. So she is four generations, me from her, removed.
Mm-hmm. So four generations. So that means we are four generations from the slave period.
Well, actually, let's start at the beginning, because really it involves a little bit more than that. I mean, we do have Aunt Harriet, but remember, she had her parents, and then they had parents that were also enslaved in the South. So we're really going back several more generations. When we talk about the Ross family and its beginnings, there were three generations of slave masters also involved. So it was like the family was working and not being paid, of course, they were enslaved and working for three different sets of slave masters. And that's where our story begins, on the eastern shore of Maryland, right outside of Cambridge, Maryland, in two counties, Caroline County and Dorchester County. So that's the beginnings of the Harriet Tubman story, not only with her own growing up in slavery, but also those of her siblings, and of course her parents, and then her parents' parents.
Her parents' parents. Mm-hmm. It's mind-boggling to think that for hundreds of years, people in this country and globally enslaved Africans.
Absolutely, and that was the bottom line. In this country, for 250 years, Africans or African Americans. Now, when I say that, I mean true Africans, as well as their children, once they got here, African Americans, were the backbone of the economy without payment. They slaved day in and day out. They slaved for 12 hours a day, no pay, every week, every year. It was the most cruel, brutal enslavement imaginable, and family separation was always the dread for our family. Mm.
So how did you actually come up with the title? And I'm really interested in, I mean, the title is multi-layered in its meaning when I read the title, Beyond the Underground. So we know about the Underground Railroad, particularly if you're from New York and you're from the Eastern Corridor of New York.
Right.
I'm in the Albany area. We have a long tradition of believing and understanding that there was something called the Underground Railroad. Mm-hmm. But you start with a very layered title, which says Beyond the Underground. And then you go down one more step and you say Aunt Harriet. So then there's another level. And
right.
Then you take it one more level and you say Moses of her people.
Absolutely.
So just reading the title, you sort of begin to understand that there's more to Harriet Tubman than what we know on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
Because first, it's beyond the underground, and she's an aunt. And to the Moses to her people. Tell my listeners a little bit more about that.
Right. Well, we came up with the title Beyond the Underground because Aunt Harriet was a full woman. She was a woman who did amazing things and extraordinary things, but all of her work was not centered on the Underground Railroad. About 10 years of it was, and she did amazing things during those 10 years. But she also served in the Civil War and did amazing things there. She also was a co-founder of the National Association of Colored Women's Clubs. She was also the founder of the John Brown Home for the Aged in Auburn, New York, where she used an old bricklayer's dormitory and converted it into what I would call the first nursing home for African Americans in the country, where she wanted to make sure that African Americans who were elderly or indigent and didn't have proper health care could be taken care of. So her passion for serving others spanned more than just the work on the Underground Railroad. So that's why Beyond the Underground Railroad. And then we look at her as being our aunt. My gosh, my mother is always saying, oh my God, can you imagine that we have someone so, you know, so amazing as a relative in our family? And we are all of us so awed by the fact that we are truly bloodline related to Harriet Tubman. Moses of her people does then again bring us back around to the Underground Railroad, where that's what she was called. You know, like Moses leading the folks, out of Egypt.
Yes.
She was doing the very same thing by taking our people from the land of bondage, from the south to the north, which was considered the land of freedom. And so, therefore, she got the name Moses of her people. So we think that the title does kind of give a sense that the book is going to give you much more information about Aunt Harriet, more than most people know.
Well, I want my listeners to know that I thank you so much for sending me the book. I had an opportunity to read it cover to cover, and it is a fantastic book. And the thing that I loved about it was that it's the kind of book that I could put next to my reading chair. You know, some people like to read on the computer, and some people like to buy those e-books, and I have some of those.
Right.
But I am a book person. I like to feel it. I like to turn the pages. I like to fold the pages over. I like to write notes in the margins. I'm a book person.
Yes.
And so this book sat next to my reading chair for weeks, and it wasn't the kind of book that I could rush through because I wanted to absorb it. And so I took time to sit. It's a good read with a cup of tea or coffee.
Sure,
if you're a
is.
Wine drinker, you can you can do that too if you choose to.
That's right.
But I'm a teetotaler,
right.
So for me, it was the kind of book that I would sit down and read in the evening time when I wanted my mind clear of the world's troubles, right?
Right.
Because we're in the COVID-19 pandemic right now, right?
We certainly are.
I needed something that would lift my spirits. And this book, even though it's in a very difficult time period, just reading about her victories and her challenges reassured me that I can still overcome what's going on around me.
Absolutely, and I think that's the message. The message is no matter how hard, no matter how many obstacles, no matter how much hard work, there's still hope. There's still a future out there, and that's what we should be striving for and working for. Nothing comes in the moment. It's all about life, which is living life to its extent. And where we are now is a moment that has to be dealt with. But like Aunt Harriet would say, she would say, just keep going. Just keep going.
Oh, my goodness. We are out of time. Ms. Galvin, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Reclaiming History, where we are talking about your wonderful book. To my listeners, tune in next time for part two of my interview with Michelle Galvin, the author of Beyond the Underground, Aunt Harriet, Moses of Her People by Joyce Stokes Jones and Michelle Jones Galvin. Guys, that was a great book. To my listeners, make sure you get a copy, guys, one of those real inspirational books. And guess what? Ms. Galvin and I spoke for a long time, so part two is coming up.
Nice. That book sounds amazing. For those of y'all just tuning in, I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I'm Lavonia Mallory, and you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM in Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM also in Albany. But I'm coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, but Guy, I'm still on my couch.
And I'm still at the foot of my bed. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, you can text us at 518-888-3004.
Protests have spread nationwide over the police killing of George Floyd, an unarmed, handcuffed African-American man in Minnesota, whose neck was kneeled on by police officers as he cried that he could not breathe. Prior to his killing, WOOC correspondent Elizabeth Press spoke to Anastasia Robinson of Justice for Demeek, a group dedicated to ending police brutality in Troy, about this pandemic and racism.
Today, I'm joined by Anastasia Robinson of Justice for Demeek, a group dedicated to ending police brutality in Troy. We are talking about what it is like for people of color in this pandemic time. Welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Anastasia, these times in general are strange and scary. Specifically, I'm thinking about figures from the nonpartisan AMP research lab that shows staggering racial divide in coronavirus deaths across the United States. It says Black Americans are dying of COVID-19 at 3 times the rate of white folks. I'm also thinking about the hunting down and murder of Ahmaud Arbery, and the most recently the killing of Breonna Taylor. I was wondering if you could speak to these times specifically around racism.
It seems that there's a number of things going on in terms of addressing race, the disparity in terms of the epidemic. One, it's really, really hard for anyone to get a test these days, unless you're on your deathbed. Then you have the issue when it comes to the Black community of people either not having sufficient insurance or maybe any insurance, which really should not be playing a role in this, because all testing and treatment is supposed to be covered. Then we do have the underlying issue of health, people with overweight, high blood pressure, diabetes, etc. And all those things play in, and it's all basically from the fundamental structure of racism that we have in this country, where all these, why we have so many disparities, lack of access to clinics or doctors, not receiving proper care, being misdiagnosed, or just being pushed to the side, your concerns. These type of things, they all play into that. And it all comes from the underfunding. It comes from a lack of a willingness to address these areas of disparity to prevent these type of situations. And then you also have people who are fearful, and people really don't know who to trust anymore when it comes to getting information. We have a president who seems to, his desire is to initiate a lot of what's happening. He just waves a lot of flags. He says things unnecessarily that prompt or send signals to those that are of a racist mindset that it is okay to do this. And then you have the rest of the government who's not really stepping in to address any of these concerns. They say you have Ahmaud Arbery out jogging, and you have people that gun him down for no apparent reason other than the color of his skin, but yet they weren't immediately arrested. There was no immediate investigation. It was all pushed to the side until it came out in the public, and the public kind of forced their hand. You shouldn't have to force a hand. When a wrong is done, and it needs to be addressed. It sends a message to the world that it's okay that these things are taking place, that it's okay that you want to gun someone down. It's okay that you want to use someone's color as your defense for inappropriate behaviors and actions, that life is not worth anything more than really reopening this economy. And that's the that's basically the bottom line on why we're even reopening at this point. We have no cure, we have no treatment, we have not enough knowledge. The information changes daily on what the symptoms are, what we should be looking for, whether you wear a mask, you don't wear a mask, whether you social distance, whether you go to work. It's just a big mess. And unfortunately, your frontline workers, the majority of them, happen to be people of color. So your numbers are going to be high in that respect also, because the person that's the CNA that's working in the nursing homes, the orderlies, all the people that are loading and unloading trucks, working in the stores, keep making sure that we have food and the necessities that we need. All these people, the majority of them happen to be people of color who are constantly exposed to this virus. Yeah, we're dying, but we're dying because you're not providing the necessary PPE. You are rushing to open up stuff that doesn't need to be open. Why you think it's necessary to open a nail salon? It's really about dollars and cents. and whether you're addressing the pandemic itself, or if you're addressing the racism itself, because no one's addressing the issues that they need to be.
A coalition in Schenectady had a run for Ahmed Arbery and a run for their own police victim, Andrew Kersey. Can you talk about these events and how Capital District organizations plan to collaborate on holding officials accountable?
The overall purpose is to bring attention to the fact that these things are taking place. It's almost like testing the waters. It's like when these incidents happen and people sit back to see, well, what is law enforcement going to do? What does our nation have to say about these type of incidents? And you get silence. So people, even though we're in the midst of a pandemic, it is still necessary to carry on the fight and to make our voices heard. So things like the walk, the ride rallies, and things of that nature, they're out there fighting. That it is not okay that this country seems to want to go backwards. We have a lot of people who don't like what's happening, but at the same time, a lot of folks aren't saying anything at all. And that makes the situation worse. Complacency is as bad as being the perpetrator.
Anastasia Robertson, could you talk about justice for Demeek's involvement for the fight for justice, the fight for accountability from police officers and government officials?
The fight is a long fight. It's going to be a long, it's a long road to victory. And like I said earlier, unfortunately, when you have leadership that is doing all that it can to keep everyone behind rose-colored glasses and, run from the truth, it does make the situation much harder. But we cannot allow open season on Black people, on any person for that matter, but definitely not on Black people, because that seems to be the scope. I mean, from something as simple as having this pandemic that started in China, to China turning around and kicking Blacks, Africans, out of their homes, out of not allowing them to rent rooms in hotels, putting up signs in stores that we're not serving Black people anymore, to coming all the way across the, laying the blame for this pandemic at the feet of Blacks. Then you come across the waters to here and you have people walking in stores with hoods on. And nobody thinks anything of it. All of these little incidents that are like testing grounds to see how far we can push this. We need the white community to stand up and say that if this is not okay, then it's not okay, and to make that voice loud and clear. It cannot just be in a bubble where it's just Black people who are complaining and saying that, look at what is happening. As part of Justice for Damit, we do our best to make it apparent to everyone that whether it's police brutality, whether it's outright racism, that it is not acceptable. And we will do all that we can to bring names, bring faces into the picture to let people know these are the people that need to be held accountable. As she said, there's an upcoming election for the DA in Albany. The one that's there has to go. He's complicit in this. All those, our president in the beginning talked about draining the swamp. Well, the swamp has not been drained. In fact, it's gotten more crowded. And in terms of Black people, it puts us not only at a disadvantage, but it also has an undercurrent of fear that runs with it. Because there's really no one out there that's saying this has got to stop and that it is not acceptable for all this racism to be out here and for people to boldly do it with more or less the president's permission to do so. It's a fearful time, but it's also a hopeful time. And just like this pandemic, we will get through that. We will also get through this, but it's going to take fighting. It's going to take the full collaboration of various organizations and groups working together, because we already see that the upper leadership, whether it's of the country or the government itself, are not going to do their part.
That was Elizabeth Press speaking with Anastasia Robinson of Justice for Demeek.
Up next, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Michelle Masurgeon talks with Christian Garamoni of the Albany chapter of the Party for Socialism and Liberation about funding corporations versus supporting the working class as it relates to stable housing.
Hello, all. This is Michelle Masurgeon, and my guest today is Christian Garamone with the Albany chapter of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you so much for allotting me this time this morning.
A lot of housing advocates have been pushing to cancel the rent since mid-March, as folks have lost their jobs and businesses started shutting down during the pandemic. And the federal government and most states responded by implementing temporary eviction moratoriums only for non-rent payment. So why are these temporary eviction moratoriums not sufficient to keep housing stable for people?
Right. So the issue with the rent moratoriums is, or the eviction moratoriums, is that as soon as they lift the moratorium, all back rent's going to be owed. So all these people who are living in precarity, who are unemployed right now due to the pandemic, all of their rent's going to come due as soon as they lift this. It's a temporary measure, and all it does is keep people housed in for uncertain terms. In New York, for example, likely till the middle of June, maybe August, depending if they can argue that their lack of income is related to the pandemic. But so if we cancel the rents, all these people, the back rents go away. They will be able to start paying as soon as they start getting income again. They won't owe all this back rent.
So talk about what's going to be happening on Saturday, May 30th. What's the message of this protest?
Gotcha. So on Saturday, May 30th, we are going to be meeting at the Albany High School parking lot at noon. We're part of a nationwide protest calling for a national cancellation of all rents, mortgages for homeowners, small landlords, and small businesses for the duration of the pandemic. So we're going to be holding a small rally, observing all social distancing and PPE requirements in the parking lot, and then we're going to having a car caravan where we drive through working class neighborhoods in Albany, rallying support and organizing the people to demand better and to demand that they are stably housed for the duration of the pandemic.
What's the message? What are you trying to tell the federal government? What would you like them to do?
We would like them to cancel the rents. We would like them to take the side of the people, to put people over profits, and to make sure that this pandemic doesn't just come back to life as soon as these eviction moratoriums are up, leading to widespread houselessness. We want people to remain housed. We want people to be able to continue living with dignity.
So are you asking the federal government to continue with stimulus payments and preserve the expanded unemployment benefit?
Yes, we are asking the federal government to continue with the stimulus, to continue with the expanded unemployment benefits. The pandemic is still, we're still in the middle of it. 37 million people have lost their jobs since March. We're in the worst depression since the 1930s, and it's only getting worse. We demand that the government continue and increase the benefits that they're giving. We demand that they cancel the rent, which is something that they have not done yet, and they need to do.
So if they don't do that and folks get evicted, where are they going?
Right. They have nowhere to go. The only option for people, if they are made houseless by this pandemic and they're all evicted once the moratorium's up, is to go to DSS. And DSS is already overloaded with cases. They are placing people in shelters, and shelters are not conducive to protecting people in the midst of a pandemic. People can't socially distance in shelters, and it's just not how this should go. And particularly in the Albany area, the crisis is hitting hard. Over 60% of Albany residents are renters, nearly double the national average. 45% of Albany renters spend over 35% of their income on the rent. The median rent in Albany is $896 per month, which requires a household income of $36,000 to be affordable. However, the median income for Albany renters is only $29,000. Albany residents are at a constant risk of homelessness in ordinary times. This pandemic is going to push thousands of people over the edge and into houselessness. So that's why we're seeking to organize, to come together and demand that the federal government and the state government protect the people put the people first and cancel the rent.
What about undocumented and the homeless?
Right.
Because I also understand that Republicans have vowed not to redo the extra unemployment money when it comes up again for a vote in July. And a lot of states are running out of funding, you know, to make up their share of, you know, all these lost funding. So, I mean, is DSS going to have enough money? You know, how are these undocumented and homeless people going to make
it? Right. So we're demanding that all undocumented people are given full access, full rights. The dichotomy between undocumented and citizen is an evil one, and it's pernicious and one that needs to be done away with. Homeless people and homeless undocumented people need to be placed in vacant housing units and vacant hotel rooms for the duration of this pandemic. The government has the ability to seize these properties, to make use of vacant housing units, and they need to do that. People should not be houseless at any time, let alone during the midst of a pandemic where it is even more dangerous to be houseless.
So the federal government over the last 20 years has been decreasing funding for even public housing, and public housing right now is really old and needs funding just to keep itself in shape. What do you think is going to happen down the road?
For sure. No, that's definitely been the trend. What we're trying to do is organize to stop that trend, right? We're trying to develop class consciousness in, amongst the people, to organize and demand more, to demand that the federal government and state governments put money into housing, put money into public housing, and that we actually house all the people. The working class is the essential class. We are the class that keeps the country moving. Since the start of the pandemic, the federal government has pumped at least $5 trillion into big banks and large corporations. So the money is there. The government can invest this money. They have not been made to. They are beholden to the ruling class. What we need to do is organize, come together and unite and make sure that they are beholden to us, that the government serves us as the people, and that they have the ability to provide shelter for all of us.
So are you looking to say that housing is a right and to kind of decommodify housing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of our core beliefs, is that commodification of housing is a heinous, it's a crime, it's immoral, and that we need to be housing everyone, and that the government has the ability to do that, and they are choosing not to because they align themselves with the capitalists who make money off of our need for housing. They exploit our every need, and we seek to put an end to that.
So we're going to have to wrap it up here. Do you have anything else you would like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So this economic crisis has revealed that behind the facade of democracy, the United States is a dictatorship of the capitalist class. The contradictions of capitalism are becoming more apparent as we head into our third month of quarantine. The essential workers in Albany are those whose backs the ruling class stomps on, are still at work, keeping the city alive while capital sits and reaps the benefits. This, however, is not good enough. Cuomo and the Albany lawmakers have gotten their orders. They are putting plans in place to reopen the entire economy. The populations who are dying from this pandemic, the populations who are going to continue dying at even greater rates if the ruling class gets its way, are the same populations whose lives have consistently and constantly been sacrificed to grease the wheels of U.S. capitalism as imperialism, Black and Indigenous people. As soon as the numbers came out about who were dying in this pandemic, the governments have rapidly increased the rate at which they seek to reopen the economy. That's why we are demanding that the government put the people first, that the government cares about, that we as a working class come together to protect our Black and Indigenous brothers and sisters, and that we as a working class demand that they cancel the rents and ensure that we can stay safe.
Christian, where can folks get more information?
So if people are looking for more information, they can go to canceltherents.org. That's R-E-N-T-S.org. Or they can view our party's website at pslweb.org.
And the information for the car caravan protest on Saturday, May 30th will be on that website?
Yes, that'll be on cancelthereents.org.
Okay, very good. Well, Christian, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
And this is Michelle Masurgeon for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Another good segment from Michelle Masurgeon interviewing Christian Guillermo of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. The Cancel the Rent Car Caravan protest will take place May 30th at 12 noon in the Albany High School parking lot, 700 Washington Avenue. For more information, go to cancelthe rents.org.
And to close out the show, Eileen Javier speaks with Lisa Good, founding director of Urban Grief, a trauma-informed community-based organization that educates on the effects of violence and supports those affected through outreach and victim advocacy. Lisa talks about trauma and adverse childhood experiences, health disparities, COVID-19, and their impact on our urban community.
Hello, Lisa. Welcome back to the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work that you do in our community?
Hello, and thank you for having me back. You guys are like family to me, so this is really great. My name is Lisa Good, and I am the founder of Urban Grief. And the vision of Urban Grief is to really foster resilient and peaceful communities, empower to promote healing in the face of crisis. And part of our core mission is to respond to trauma, crisis, and grief by providing comprehensive solutions to individuals and communities. And so a big part of that work is reaching and supporting victims of violence, of community violence in particularly, and homicide survivors, but also a part of my urban grief work and also, you know, some of the training and consulting work that I do is around educating and talking to everyday people. And when I say everyday people, I mean non-clinical people, you know, non-medical people, just about what trauma is, adverse childhood experiences, and resilience and healing, and how those different areas kind of overlap in our lives. That's a little bit about what I do. And I've lived in the Capital Region pretty much all my life, and this is my home, and I have a vested interest in seeing people in my community not just survive, but also thrive and do well.
Can you talk a little bit about compounded grief and how now tragedy can build upon all pain?
You know, so with the COVID-19 and looking at the health disparities specifically related to COVID-19, however, while acknowledging that many of those disparities existed long before COVID-19 came into play, with the onset of COVID-19, part of the impact is that there are many community members feeling multiple layers of loss. They're experiencing multiple layers of loss. And so when you think about a lot of our communities and you think about essential workers and who are the people that are actually on some of these front lines. And when I say front lines, I mean the things, the services that we actually kind of take for granted, like fast food and restaurants and housekeeping staff, the food service staff of mm-hmm. the hospital, the people who register patients at the hospitals. And so I think that when we think about frontline workers, essential workers, we've really kind of have a constricted view of that. And even though media now is kind of acknowledging all of these different service areas, has a part of essential work that is necessary to kind of keep us moving along or keep things operationalized, while they're being recognized, value is not really being assigned to their work. In that regard, they're almost viewed as expendable to some degree. And that is, to me, a loss, right? So you have a job and you have to keep your job because you're glad to have a job because so many people have lost a job. But at the same time, because there's not, we give lip service to the value of what you do and how you are contributing to the sustainability of some semblance of life as we kind of once knew it, you're not given the same value. The same value is not assigned to your sacrifice as it is to the sacrifices of, let's say, doctors or nurses or those kinds of folks. And so that's a loss. But then there are these other losses that are being experienced. The loss of employment, the loss of a stable income, the loss of security that is associated with your housing. So if you're economically distressed because you lost your job and now that jeopardizes your housing, it may jeopardize your transportation if your car is repossessed. And so when we talk about losses, they're layered and they're many, but also the loss of even something, you know, even childcare, right? Childcare access, school, you know, just certain things that we've taken for, not taken for granted, but they are part of our everyday life that even in the context of a marginalized community, these are things that help sustain the community and keep people going. And, you know, now all of a sudden in COVID-19, we have the just collapsing of some of these real basic services that and systems that really allow people to survive and have some level of sustainability. And so that's a loss, right? Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, there is also this loss of security. So some losses are very tangible and concrete, and then other losses are kind of ambiguous. But the loss of security, the loss of safety, the loss of physical health. And we're not talking about that as much, but because so many people have died from COVID, I don't know if we are having conversations around the people who survived COVID and what their lives are like after that, because not everybody goes back to 100% pre-COVID. And so people are experiencing losses around health. They're experiencing losses in relationship to people dying. But even in the context of people dying, not having the opportunity to go and be present, people are experiencing losses around rituals that we have historically had as it relates to death and dying and grieving. So all of these layers of loss are built upon the old trauma and the old pain that exist in a lot of our communities. If the networks of support were already stretched, like if the budget was already stretched to the max just to put food on the table or keep a roof over someone's head, you know, and here comes COVID, it doesn't take a lot more pressure for those safety nets, whether they're social, whether they're financial, whether they're spiritual, whether they're emotional, to break because they were already extended and stretched to the max because of the long-term marginalization and disinvestment in communities because of racism and discrimination, because of the experiences that people have when dealing with healthcare systems.
Go.
That was Eileen Xavier speaking with Lisa Good of Urban Grief. Lisa Good is one of the feature experts at our Health Autonomy Clinic addressing social disparity and crisis, which will take place Tuesday, June 2nd. To register for this free event, go to mediasanctuary.org. For more information, go to Urban Grief. Please visit them at www.urbangrief.org. Hey, Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again?
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight is Alexis. Remember to tune back in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio efforts, shoot us an email. info@mediasanctuary.org. That's info@mediasanctuary.org, or tune in for one of our virtual meetings by Zoom Monday nights at 7:07 by sending an email requesting an invitation to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. But until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.